Welcome to the second season of the Duct Industry Podcast. Like in 2020, the podcast was realized in collaboration with the What's Up with Dogs podcast and the programmers of Color Collective. Join us for discussions on topics such as the limited representation of brown LGBTQ+ stories in the cinematic space, the lack of inclusivity in the mainstream press, and the possibilities of Caribbean avant-garde cinema. The Doc Industry podcasts are funded by Creative Europe, the City of Leipzig, MDM, and BKM. Thank you to our partners and collaborators for their contribution. Enjoy.
Thank you so much for being on the show today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Joni.
And Ranelle and I also want to extend a thank you to the Doc Leipzig team for inviting us back to be part of these series of podcasts that they're doing for the festival. So this is very exciting. And also I'm very excited to have this conversation with you because my background, how I got started in documentary was through archival research. Mm-hmm. And I still do that on the side because I'm a nerd and I love to like look up things and I love history. And I actually, when I was doing this epic train trip across the country back from the East Coast to the West Coast. And I actually spent some time in Washington, DC and went to the Library of Congress. And for those who are in the US who work as archival researchers, the Library of Congress has a lot of items, footage and documents that are a public domain. So it was like really great to kind of to actually be in that space that, you know, houses the people's history. And it also kind of speaks to the importance of like the need for some of these institutions, because if it weren't for some of these institutions, these items would not be preserved. And we're going to be getting into some of that and how it relates to what's happening in Afghanistan. I wanted to first ask you, particularly for our audience members who might not know about you, first of all, like, how did you get into documentary filmmaking?
Well, it's an interesting story in a way, because I started out as a documentary filmmaker and then I took a detour into the art world for 20 years and then I came back to documentary filmmaking. Yeah, that's basically how it happened. Yeah.
Okay. So what made you get out and then what made you get back in?
Well, yeah, I made an experimental documentary in my early 20s as actually my BA thesis. This was the 90s. It was comparative literature. Anything could be a text, including your own text, could be films, and then you could analyze them yourself. I mean, it was a wild time, you know, the 90s in comp lit. I got interested in experimental documentary through the work of Walid Raad and Jay Saloom and Mona Hatoum. And then Mona Hatoum really took me on this other path where I was like, I saw her solo show at the New Museum in New York. And it was the first time I'd seen anything in a museum that really spoke to me and my own experience. And it really blew my mind in a way. And I thought, oh, art can be about this. Art can be about politics, or it can be about exile, and it can end up in museums. Wow, okay. And so then I started thinking, okay, well maybe art school is the way, not film school. And okay. Then I ended up in art school. That's the short version of the story.
And so so what kind of art were you creating? Like, what was your focus? Were you doing like video installations, or what were you working on?
Yeah, I was always working with lens-based practices. I was working with moving image primarily, but I was making, you know, multiple channel installations, videos with spatialized surround sound, interactive video art in the early 2000s, but I, you know, stopped doing that once my career became international, because those things break really easily. And when you're not personally there to fix them, it doesn't really remain a practical thing to keep making. And I made net art also in the 2000s. I did a lot of that. and then I started working a lot with archives.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Both archives as material and also the construction of archives as artworks.
Right.
So yeah. And photography and sound. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's great, kind of like going back into the history of that. And it's weird to think of like the 90s as history. But I guess it is. I'm 50, so I'm like, ooh, 90s is history. Like that was just like 5 years ago, right? You know?
Yeah, I know.
But it seems like a lot more documentary filmmakers are incorporating some of like these various experimental techniques. Now, whereas like in the 90s, it was kind of like, you know, radical and but we actually see some of these techniques that maybe we've seen in like art installations and museums being used mm-hmm. by filmmakers, like just in their film. This needs to be a lot more of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think I became more interested in the idea of making a feature length documentary when I started to see feature length documentaries looking more like artworks. Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And adopting more of these kind of hybrid and experimental practices that had already been circulating in the art world for quite a long time. So,
right.
Yeah. The other thing that happened, of course, was that I started working on a project that clearly wanted to be a feature. And, you know, sometimes content dictates its own form. And that's really what happened to me with What We Left Unfinished. It just so obviously wanted to be a feature film. Like, you know,
right.
I worked on it in all these other ways. You know, I worked mm-hmm. with the material as live cinema events. I, you know, did an exhibition or a series of exhibitions. I made, you know, all kinds of little mini objects and different, I did all these different panel discussions, but like it just wanted to be a feature film. Mm-hmm. So that's what I ended up making.
So what We Left Unfinished has had many lives and many incarnations.
Yes, it really okay. has.
That's great. So is this the final incarnation, or do you feel like there's more you could do with it, other things you could do with it?
I mean, I did at one point think I could also make a book out of it.
That's a great idea. Like stills from mm-hmm. the films and with quotes mm-hmm. from the filmmakers and the mm-hmm. actors. And yes, okay, you should do that. Okay. I think it'd be, okay, but yeah, we can get into that later. So since we're getting into What We Left Unfinished, tell our audience, for those who don't know and need to know, what is What We Left Unfinished?
What We Left Unfinished is a feature-length documentary about five unfinished films from the communist period in Afghanistan, and that's 1978 to 1991. And it basically brings together newly rediscovered and restored footage from these lost films with interviews with the people who worked on them and the kind of behind the scenes stories of the really extraordinary lengths that they went to keep making films in this period. And this was a period when filmmaking was really seen as a political tool. Mm. And so it became a deeply politicized act to continue making films under the communist regime. And films were seen as weapons. Filmmakers were seen, you know, as either participating in or resisting the regime. And they were subject to political oppression, to censorship, to attacks from opponents of the regime. There are wild, wild stories in the film about what resulted from this. and also it was a real DIY driven kind of yes. filmmaking that was going on in Afghanistan at this time. So there's also wild stories that result from that.
Yes, those stories were really great. And I think for anyone who loves films that are about films and filmmaking, like this is a film that people should see, you know, from that aspect, because like stories are a little cray cray. Like, you did what? Like, really?
Yeah.
But it's really fascinating. So you cover in the project five films. So can you mm-hmm. tell us about, just give us a brief synopsis of like Wrong Way?
Mm-hmm. Wrong Way is an unfinished film by the director Juan Cher Hayabi, and it was made during the kind of tail end of the communist period, which is the period of reconciliation, the attempted reconciliation by the last communist president, Najibullah, with the Mujahideen. And it's really a film made in this spirit of reconciliation. It's a film about two brothers who are on opposing sides of this conflict. And one is with the Mujahideen, one is with the regime. And, you know, through their conflict, you also see how this split has divided a village, a border village. It's really reflective of this moment in which kind of everyone wanted the war to be over. They were like, we're so sick of this war. Can't it be over already? And it sort of stages a reconciliation in advance of the reconciliation that everyone was hoping would happen. It stages a small scale reconciliation in this village, which is very dramatically staged with like people like throwing their guns away. And, like,
yes.
Families re-embracing
lots
each
of
other
hugging,
after
yes.
conflict. And it's really beautiful and weird. And yeah, it's nice. The Wrong Way in the film is referring to how, you know, by that point in the war, everyone thought both sides had lost their way.
Right.
And no one was right at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just time to make peace. Time to make peace. All right. And then Agent. Yes.
Yeah. Agent is a film from even later in this period when really there was like barely any regime functioning at that point. And it was actually produced independently. It's the only one of these five films that was produced independently by its filmmaker rather than being funded by the regime, because there was no more state funding for film at that point. The Soviet aid had all been withdrawn. And the Soviet aid was really what was fueling state funding for film.
Right.
So this is a film that was produced independently by Latif Ahmadi, its director. And it really looks at, in a kind of prescient way, the way that the heroin trade had begun to permeate so many different aspects of Afghanistan during the war. So, you know, how so many different aspects of Afghan society had become involved in this heroin trade during the war. And it's like both sides of the war were involved in it. We're using it to fund various things, or were part of the trafficking. It looks at like how, you know, even nomads were like carrying the opium from one part of the country to the other, the truckers. Like, it looks at like actually all of these different circuits that the heroin is traveling throughout the country.
So just a kind of a quick question, just for historical context, what was driving the heroin trade? Obviously their demand. Okay. But also like who was getting the money and what was the money fueling?
Yeah. I mean, I think primarily it was fueling the insurgency. So fueling the Mujahideen fight. It's very common, you know, in these kinds of civil wars for insurgent groups to fund their activities through a combination of drug trafficking, antiquities trafficking, which also very much happened in Afghanistan, jewel trafficking. If there are any kind of mineral or jewel deposits, that also gets trafficked. Like, there's just a lot of trafficking during these wars.
Right.
And that was very much the case in Afghanistan as well. And so the heroin trade, which had not really, you know, been happening on that scale, I think prior to 78, became a much, much bigger facet.
An increase, okay.
Yeah, but you know, the Soviet army also got involved in this, actually to a surprising extent, because the Soviet Union was one of the major markets for Afghan heroin. So there's a scene in Agent, which didn't make it into What We Left Unfinished, but there's a scene in Agent where you see heroin being packed into coffins that are being flown back to the Soviet Union by the Soviet Union. Right. And that is one of the ways actually that they were reportedly, that heroin was reportedly trafficked back to the Soviet Union. They would actually burn bodies and then pack the coffins full of heroin.
Whoa, okay. That's a
Yeah.
lot. Oh, wow. Okay. So downfall.
Yeah, Downfall is a film by the late Fakir Nabi. One of his only films as a director. He's mostly known as an actor, and a great, great Afghan actor. And he, it would have been his first film as a director, and it was an interesting one, like to kind of sort through the footage and figure out what had been intended to kind of be the order of scenes or how they would have been assembled, partly because they didn't finish principal photography on that film. And also partly they did a lot of reshoots. And it just wasn't as clear, I think, from the way that it was shot, how the director had originally envisioned it being assembled, as it was with some other films made by more experienced directors.
So with these films, did you happen to have you had the footage, but did you happen to have access to the some of the scripts?
No, we didn't
No,
have
okay.
access to any of the scripts. The directors, most cases, hadn't retained any of that material when they fled in the late 80s or 90s.
Right.
They'd had to leave all of that behind, and a lot of them didn't remember the original
It's
plots
a
of
long
their
time ago.
films. It's a long time ago. Yeah. But, with a film like Wrong Way, it had very, very clear scene markers on all the slates. So it was actually pretty clear how it had been meant to be constructed. And that wasn't necessarily the case with every film. So, in any case, Downfall is a film that was made in the mid-communist period, which was a period of really intense paranoia about surveillance. So, for context, by that point in the 80s, the state security agency, Khad, which had been trained by the KGB and the Stasi, like they had been mentored by the KGB and the Stasi, employed about 20,000 people, some of whom were agents, but some of whom were secret informants. And I think the secret informants vastly outnumbered the actual agents. So there was this real and in many cases warranted paranoia about who might be watching you and reporting on you to Chad. And Sukut for me is a downfall. Sukut is a film for me is really born from this moment of surveillance anxiety. It's a film about, a Chad agent is the protagonist. Like the protagonist is an agent who works for Chad, who gets kind of caught up from what I could understand of the plot, which is a little murky. Yeah. Who gets caught up in a kind of criminal conspiracy that he's drawn into by some kind of old friend, which he's supposed to be investigating for Chad, but then he somehow gets implicated in through some scheme that they, set up and ensnare him in via like the daughter of the family who he falls in love with. I don't know.
Yeah,
But
that's what you think it
yeah, that's what I think it was. It was very confusing. But the thing that was really notable about it to me is that it's this kind of cops and robbers movie, essentially, but it's just full of footage of people watching each other, filming each other, photographing each other, and following each other. And that was like 20% of the footage that we had, was just surveillance.
And yeah, and because that was a real concern for folks back in the day. So just for some of our younger people, the KGB or is this the major spy entity that was part of the former Soviet Union, and Stasi was the major spy unit that was part of East Germany.
Yes,
And
that's correct.
actually in Berlin, there's a museum called the Spy Museum, which is like really, really cool. And they go into all this stuff and they have like little artifacts of like all the little spy devices, not only from just like it's mainly like Soviet Union in the US. So, Soviet Union of the KGBB versus the CIA, but they go into stuff with other countries too. It's really cool and a little scary. And I feel like we think we know. We feel like they know like what we're doing now because we have all these smartphones and that, but there was a lot going back in basically at the height of the Cold War. There's a lot happening.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So Black Diamond is another film about the heroin trade. So mm-hmm. how does this differ from Agent?
Well, this was another one where the plot was really unclear. uh-huh. And the director really didn't remember anything about the plot.
Right.
But it's made not that long before Agent. So again, towards the end of this period, but it is state funded. And so it takes a kind of less neutral position, I would say, where Agent is a little more observatory in the way that it kind of uses the heroin trade as part of its plot. The Black Diamond is really, really condemns everyone who participates in trafficking. And it has like several kinds of trafficking in the plot, and everyone involved in the drug trafficking who's also, they're also like doing things like making and selling fake passports so that people can leave the country and so on, is clearly a terrible person. They do things also in the film like stage gas attacks on buses and in schools, which are similar to things that actually did happen in Kabul in that era, especially the school gas attack that's staged in that film is based on a real incident and follows it like quite closely, I think, in the particulars.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, and then last but not least, the April Revolution.
Yeah, the April Revolution is an extraordinary document in that it is a reenactment of the 1978 Afghan communist coup d'etat, staged 3 months after the actual coup d'etat and featuring the entire army and air force using, you know, real tanks, real missiles, real guns, and also featuring Hafizullah Amin, the deputy leader of the Communist Party, you know, with his family reenacting the moment, you know, when he gave the order to start the coup d'etat from house arrest in his apartment. So they restage that in his actual apartment with his with his family. This is because the whole thing was scripted by Hafizullah Amin. So
right.
It was his project from the outset. There's supposedly 36 more minutes of footage with Hafizullah Amin that has been totally lost. And I wasn't able to find any of that footage. I was only able to find, you know, the 3.5 minutes that was used in a Soviet documentary co-produced by Uzbek Film, directed by the Uzbek filmmaker Malik Kayumov, which features the Hafizullah Amin footage, but with that kind of Russian voiceover that's very snarky that I did use in my film because I thought it was so remarkable. It kind of shows the intense like shift in the political view of Hafizullah Amin that is put forward by the Soviets after they assassinate him, which they did like quite shortly after that, just before the documentary is released. And you know, not very long after the film was shot.
Right.
That's the reason it's never finished, of course, is because it was a project of Amin's, and he was deposed, assassinated, and very quickly villainized in like 20 different ways.
So how did the archive in Russia get that footage of the film if it wasn't finished?
Well, actually, the story that I have heard, and this is, of course, hearsay, is that Malik Kayumov came to Afghanistan to make his documentary about the Afghan Revolution, Afghanistan, the Revolution Continues. Mm-hmm. And he basically took all of the footage featuring Hafizullah Amin from this unfinished documentary. He just took it from Afghan film. And took it back to Uzbekistan with the intent of using it in his documentary. And so the only part of it that I was able to find is the part that's in the Finnish documentary, because the Finnish documentary is in the Krasnogorsk archive in Moscow. But the footage he didn't end up using would have been stored at Uzbek Film, and Uzbek Film dissolved in the 90s, when the Soviet Union dissolved. Uzbek Film was completely disbanded. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it is somewhere in Tashkent, like in someone's house.
Yeah, in someone's house, in a basement, in a box, somewhere, yeah.
Because stuff resurfaces from Uzbek Film occasionally, so.
Right.
I mean, I know people kept things, so I'm sure it's there somewhere, but I wasn't able to find it, you know, in time for making What We Left Unfinished, but I continue to put out into the world my desire to see it someday. I would love to see the rest of this footage someday. What I did was buy the footage from Krasnogorsk, the 3.5 minutes. Because I took to them an official letter from Afghan Film requesting the return of this footage.
Yes, okay.
And they said no. So then I bought it and returned it. But it was so expensive, I was only able to buy it in HD, you know, because they were charging so much money for it.
So how much did they, since we're getting in deep into the archival stuff, like how much was it? Like how much was it per minute or per second? Like what are their rates?
I believe the 3.5 minutes was $3,500 for HD.
For HD. Goodness.
So 4K was like, 4K was, I think, 3 or 4 times as much. And I was in a pretty early stage in the film then, and I definitely did not have that much money for licensing.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So even over there, like I thought ABC News Source was expensive, but I guess even over there, it's pricey.
Yeah, Russian archives are not cheap. Yeah.
Yes, okay. Yeah. So I just wanted to ask, like, how did you find out about these films? Particularly considering they're unfinished. Did you how did you discover these? Like, were they kind of in the zeitgeist? Did you hear about had you heard about these filmmakers from like your parents when you were growing up? How did you know about these?
So I first started hearing about these particular films, and in particular the first one I heard about was The April Revolution. During a proof of concept digitization workshop that I helped run at Afghan Film in 2012, during a series of workshops that were put together for Documenta 13, the big periodic exhibition in Germany, which had in the 13th edition a kind of auxiliary project in Kabul, which I was part of. And
so was that project helping, like, just basically help creating opportunities for people to digitize these archives for the preservation purposes?
Yeah, essentially what Afghan Film wanted was for us to help them put together a proof of concept that would allow them to then raise money to digitize the entire archive, which is what they wanted to do. And we, you know, we only had 10,000 euros for this workshop. So we said, we can give you a proof. We can help you do a proof of concept version where we, you know, digitize like 30 films and from different periods and genres. And we do them with the existing machine that they had, which was a Spirit Telecine from the 90s, which digitizes to like HDV tape.
Okay.
So, you know, your highest resolution is 480p.
Right.
Which obviously not ideal these days.
No, yeah.
Not considered archival now.
Right.
And also it was broken. The Telecine was broken. So I was working with colleagues from PADMA, the Public Access Digital Media Archive Collective out of Mumbai. They recruited a Telecine technician from Bollywood, Vijay Chauhan, who came up to Kabul along with Shaina Anand, Ashok Sukumaran, Faiza Khan from PADMA. They all came up to Kabul and we spent 3 weeks in the archive.
Wow.
Vijay fixed everything that he saw that was broken, literally everything.
Right.
You know, processors, Steenbecks, Telecine, and then he trained everyone who wanted to learn to use the Telecine, and they became like really, really adept at it.
Right.
which then came in really good stead once they were able to raise funds to buy a newer Telecine. They'd already gotten very familiar with the whole process.
Right.
And a lot of the theory around color and light and so on. And dealing with fragile film and fragile splice points and all of these material questions.
Yeah, because that's something probably a person who's not familiar with like working in archives really doesn't understand is it's not just the issue of like collecting the archives, but it's also the preservation, but also like handling archives that are delicate, like in this original state. Like I remember the first film I worked on, Bridging Divide, Tom Bradley, Politics of Race, I went to the Los Angeles City Archives and they had all this, all this footage on reels, you know, 16 millimeter reels that had not been looked at in like 40 years. And had not even been open. So we actually had to find like someone who knew how to, well, had to bring a machine to look at those reels, but also who knew how to splice it, because when we were watching it, it would break because it was so delicate. So like, you know, handling and putting it back together. And we were able to use some of that footage, but and digitize what we needed for the film, but the rest of that, and there were like hundreds of reels there, was not even looked, because it wasn't relevant to what we needed, but it's just still sitting there in its original state, decaying. And there was some fascinating stuff, like there was all this footage of the Watts riots that had been shot by the LAPD, because this was like the LAPD archives, and it's not the normal stuff that you see in films about about the Watts rebellion, but also there were like funny things like Khrushchev at Disneyland. which was an interest to me, because my grandfather, who I love dearly, he used to make me memorize the names of the Soviet premiers and then recite them back to him and write them down. But it was, I remember at the time when, you know, they were picking all these really old ones and they were dying all the time, you know, like they were like, you know, so I was like, I had like all these Russian names in my brain. But yeah, I mean, but it's like all this, there's stuff there, we just don't know what it is that's just sitting there decaying, because these archives, a lot of them don't have the resources to, and or the time or the money or the capacity to help preserve them, you know, so yeah. It's sad, you know, and a lot of people don't realize like that that's an aspect of it. So I wanted to ask you too, because like the one thing I loved about this project or this film was that it showed a completely different view of Afghanistan that we particularly here in the U.S. or the West are not used to. And I, even though the films were dealing with some of these heavy subjects, they also were scenes of just like Afghans living their like everyday lives, you know? So would you describe this time as like a golden age of Afghan cinema?
Well, the directors describe it that way, certainly.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I think one of them says that in the film. And I think from their perspective, it was, in that they were given more funding.
Yeah, they had money.
There was state support for cinema in a way that, you know, hadn't existed before and hasn't really existed since. And there was also, you know, for all of the arts, there was a kind of elevation of artists to a social position that they hadn't had before and haven't had since. This was true also for the performers. It was true for people in other artistic disciplines. There were artist unions formed, as in kind of all the Soviet-backed countries and Soviet republics. This was a pattern. They did this everywhere. They formed these artist unions, and then the heads of the unions were given diplomatic passports. They were given prominent artists or actors or directors were given apartments They were given better ration cards, you know, there was like right. there were rewards for participating in the system, but there were also a lot of dangers to being prominent participants right. in the system, especially for actors who, you know, were the faces mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. this cultural push, right?
Right.
And they remember it differently than the directors mm-hmm. do, of course. Mm. They remember it as a much more fraught and dangerous time
right.
than the directors do, because the directors were behind the camera. They were safer.
Right. right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I remember I can't remember her name, but one of the women actors, she talked about how actresses were in some circles like viewed as like prostituted women, which kind of made me think of like old Hollywood, like back in the day before the talkies. Like that was mm-hmm. like the perception that lived that was prominent back mm-hmm. then. And like, you know, it's like why? But so just speaking from like her perspective, like that were people confronting her on the street about, you know, her being in films, like what aspect of it was dangerous for her?
Well, it was more that, you know, the shoots that they did especially in more rural areas, when they ventured outside of the city mm-hmm. itself, would actually be attacked by the Mujahideen.
And you know, that part. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, the actors and the directors remember this differently, in that mm-hmm. the directors will describe it as, we were shooting and somehow we ended up in the middle of a firefight totally accidentally. And the actors, you know, will remember it as, they came after us totally deliberately, and right. they were going to kidnap us. And they said, you know, shoot the men and take the girls, like that kind of story, right? So okay. it's two very different versions of these stories that you'll get from actors and directors. The directors will mm-hmm. be like, you could totally negotiate with the Mujahideen, it was fine. And the actors will be like, I couldn't even say I was an actor. It was better to say I was a soldier.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, in the film.
Yeah.
Well, another thing that I really like appreciated this about this film is that it's such it's a celebration of these artists, as well as their fortitude and their commitment to their mm-hmm. art. Like these folks yeah. are dedicated, like yeah. hardcore, like any artist, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also it's a celebration of their work. And it seems like I noticed, like when I've traveled to overseas the festivals, particularly to Europe, there mm-hmm. seems to be almost a resurgence in filmmakers like today exploring some of these films of the past, particularly of the mm-hmm. communist era in mm-hmm. these a lot of these Soviet bloc countries, because mm-hmm. I think when the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union like ended in theory, you know, in theory, mm-hmm. There was maybe a rush to forget all these artistic works, but they do speak to a specific cultural memory, and just like any film, like capturing a moment in time. Mm-hmm. And that's what I appreciate. Well, this is what film does anyway. Like it captures moments so we can reflect and remember, but also interrogate if necessary. You know, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask in particular, because you mentioned before about some of the artists who inspired you, who were not only creating art, but like speaking exploring their experience as exiles. And mm-hmm. since a lot of these filmmakers and these actors and actresses who were on these films are in exile, like what do you see as the unique aspects of cultural memory that they're trying to explore with their work?
Do you mean, you know, in these specific films that I included in What We Left Unfinished?
Yeah, in these specific films, yeah. In mm-hmm. these specific films.
It's a little bit of a tricky question because I think at the time that they were being made, I don't know that all of these directors were making films for history, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're respecting their films to get out there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think of them, of all of these filmmakers, probably Haidari and Latif Ahmadi were really thinking about posterity, thinking about you know, films that enter into the historical record. And maybe not so much the others. You were more thinking about films as entertainment, as popular entertainment. I don't know what Dawood Farhani, who directed The April Revolution, was thinking, because of course he was dead by the time that I made What We Left Unfinished, and I couldn't interview him. I only was able to interview Latif Ahmadi, who was the cinematographer on that film, as well as the director of Agent. Certainly that was a film that was trying to address the historical record,
yes,
as well, and create a kind of document of that moment where no actual document existed,
right.
Surprise coup, there's no document. And the reason the reason The April Revolution is the first of these unfinished films that I became aware of is because it's been recycled so much. The footage from that film has been recycled into other films, often enough that it almost has come to function like a historical document of the coup.
Everybody references it as a point. Yeah.
It is the only image of that moment that exists. Even though it's fictional, it does embody that history on screen, right?
Right.
In so many other films, documentaries and fiction films that kind of refer to that historical moment, which I find fascinating, right?
And I think the unique thing about that film is just because it happened like so soon after, after what you said, like 3 months, because sometimes these films about historical moments are created a year or 10 years or 15 years afterwards, and this is like in the immediate.
I think Hafizul Amin was very interested in the historical record and how he would be remembered in it, right? And that was the project of that film for him.
And he wanted to control that narrative in a way.
For sure. But I think the interesting and tricky thing about making a film about a coup d'etat so soon after a coup d'etat is that the government wasn't actually stable yet. And so there's a story I didn't put in the film that really speaks to this, which is that when they lowered the flag of the communists on the presidential palace and put back up the flag of the monarchy temporarily to shoot, the sequence for the film of the taking over of the palace, right? People thought the government had actually fallen.
Oh, wow. Because it was too soon.
It was too soon.
right.
It was too soon. People didn't think a film was being made. They just thought the government had fallen.
Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there were real consequences to that, because some members of the Halk faction of the Communist Party, Amin's faction, who were known for their luxuriant mustaches, don't ask me why that was like a thing.
Okay.
Actually shaved their mustaches.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, when they saw the flag go down, and then they, Amin heard about this and he threw them all in prison and they were never heard from again. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
All right.
There are a lot of ways in which, the relationship between truth and fiction in these films is pretty slippery. Mm-hmm.
Right.
We talked about the gas attack incident that's kind of reproduced in The Black Diamond. There are a lot of episodes in Downfall that, according to the director, were scripted by an actual HUD agent. There are other things like that in other films. And there's, the stories that Haidari tells about the shoot he was on where he was the only actor and everyone else you know, playing soldiers were actual soldiers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That kind of thing was happening all the time in these films. There was a very lively interplay between fiction and documentary, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like there is very little division between art and life, you know? Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah. So one of my favorite quotes from the film, it's the director with the hat, who as you say, everybody loves. But he talks about film being a visual history, and it's like a person who sits in the corner and recounts all the tragedies and histories, either real or imagined.
Mm.
And like that quote to me was like so profound, because it kind of feels to me like a documentarian sensibility, mm-hmm. you know, like a verite documentary sensibility. But also when he talks about tragedies and histories, like real or imagined, he's like really getting into how memory and how we remember, like mm-hmm. already impacts like what we are going to see or perceive on screen. And mm-hmm. I just thought that was just so profound, like that very conscious, that level of consciousness of like me as the observer, like mm-hmm. shifting what is being observed. So I know I'm probably getting a little esoteric there.
And
my background is in anthropology, so I think about these things. So but I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that, particularly from the perspective of, you know, this being an archival based film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's another thing he says later in the film where he says, whatever the truth was, whether it was sweet or bitter, that's what I put in my films. And then he gives a little pause and he says, and then of course you add some dramatic flair.
Right. Right.
You know, there's a lot happening in that space between whatever the truth was, I put it in my films, and then and then you add some dramatic flair,
right? Quite <You know? laughs> spice it up. No, but it's storytelling, you know?
Yeah, it's absolutely storytelling. And mm-hmm. I mean, the reason I was interested in these unfinished films, which are fictions, you know, as material for a documentary, is of course because of that slippery relationship between document and fiction in Afghan film, and also because, you know, there's very little filmic material made during this period that escaped censorship in any way, because mm-hmm. censorship was so strong and it happened at so many stages of the filmmaking. These films also were censored at several stages in their making.
Mm-hmm.
But they escape the kind of final censor's cut, which happens when a film is edited and then has to pass through the censor before getting distributed, when they would literally go at it with scissors and then discard whatever they took out. Right?
So were these censors like folks from the Soviet Union or folks from Afghanistan who were like agents of the Soviet Union? So, like, who were these people who were... who are the people with the scissors?
I mean, from what I understand, and I think this is discussed briefly in the film, for most of this period, there was one guy who was the censor, mm-hmm. Who was Afghan, and he was that final censor with the scissors. But the Soviets came in at the point when dailies would be watched. So the Soviet advisors would watch the dailies.
They were on the set. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But also all the scripts had to go through a censorship board in order to get government funding.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
And directors were also on these censorship boards, right? So several of the directors I interviewed actually were on the censorship board at one time or another, mm-hmm. like the board that reviewed scripts, which wasn't officially called a censorship board, but was totally a censorship board.
Right.
Yeah. So they all told me, we also sent scripts back because they just weren't good enough, which I mean, may or may not be true.
Right. It's true. Like, I want to get mine made.
You just need another draft. You need another draft. Like.
Yes. And another one and another one.
Yeah.
So I just kind of want to understand like your experience as a Afghan woman, looking at this footage? Like, what did that mean for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is important to be precise about my position when I'm working with material from Afghanistan and working in Afghanistan. And, you know, that position has always been a diasporic position in that I grew up outside Afghanistan, and that always inflects how I look at Afghan film and look at any material from Afghanistan and work with any material from Afghanistan. So that there's always a certain degree of estrangement, you know, in my viewpoint that's just baked in, that is inevitable and inescapable. And, you know, I just have to kind of go with it.
Right.
So
you use the word estrangement. Because usually when we use that term, the person using that term has kind of like made a, in some ways made a choice to like kind of disassociate in some kind of way, you know, or disconnect. But in your case, it hasn't been a choice.
Yeah. I mean, I think probably I might not have used the term estrangement 3 months ago. Right. But
Okay. Because of everything.
Yeah.
So,
maybe I would have phrased it differently. I don't know. It's hard to tell right now.
But estrangement from, like, based on everything that's happened with the U.S. pulling out and the Taliban taking back over.
Things are a little weird right now. Yeah.
A lot of weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think in general, you know, the diasporic position, which is the one I've worked from all my life as an artist and as a filmmaker, is a very tricky position in that you never fully belong, you know, in either space. You're not fully from the place you're from, and you're not fully from the place you're, you know, visiting, right? Even if it's technically your homeland, right? So, you know, that is something that inflects how I work with all the material that I've worked with from Afghanistan. In the case of What We Left Unfinished, by the time I made the film, I had already been working with the archive for 6 years.
Yeah. So tell us about Afghan archive. Yeah. Well, Afghan film and the archive and what you're trying to do with that.
Oh, well, I mean, what I can. Yeah.
Is that a big question?
It's a really hard question to answer right now because the fate of the archive is very uncertain at the moment. Right.
Right.
And I don't know how much I actually can say about it. In this particular moment, that might be something we save for a part two conversation.
Okay.
I can say that, you know, following the proof of concept digitization that we did in 2011 at the invitation of the Afghan Film Archive, that was successful in helping them raise funding to recatalog the entire archive and begin digitizing the archive. Mm-hmm. And they did get quite a long way into that. They managed to do a fair bit of that digitization. Also, the other thing that I did was draw attention to what was in the archive, which just had never, some
people
parts of it had never
know
really
what was
been
in there.
Some of what was in there, like some of the more well-known among Afghans feature films, which do kind of play on national television regularly, you know, had been bootlegged and circulating on YouTube or whatever for some time. But other things that were in the archive, like the newsreel footage or the unedited footage, nobody knew that those were there. So when we put those online through Padma, that started to draw more attention from foreign filmmakers who wanted to license footage, or foreign news organizations who wanted to license footage, and also the attention of a few documentary filmmakers who became interested in the story of the archive. So that's one of the things actually that led to, for example, Pietro Brett-Kelly's film, A Flickering Truth. And then Ariel Nasser's film, The Forbidden Reel. So it did generate this additional interest in and excitement about the archive and its story. which mm-hmm. is a remarkable story of these people who sacrificed a lot to preserve these films mm-hmm. through a lot of conflict and a lot of hardship.
Yeah. I mean, the guy who says, if they ask me for the key, mm-hmm. I'll just say I lost it. Yeah. And that's in reference to, correct me if I'm wrong, but basically he was trying to protect these archives and he was still in the country and he had mm-hmm. access to them, but you know, he was going to like deny in mm-hmm. on the efforts and the goals of preservation, you know, if it came down to it.
Yeah, that was during the previous Taliban regime, and mm-hmm. It was one of the factors that led to the preservation of most of the archive from the Taliban during that mm-hmm. time.
Right.
Which is, at this point, a very well-known story, and there are many, many of the people who were involved in defying the Taliban at that time are still alive, and so they're now at increased risk because of that.
Right.
Yeah,
and it's a powerful stand to take because this is like the preservation of history.
And it's also, you know, for many of these people it was the preservation of their own life's work.
These are people
who mm-hmm. who worked at Afghan Film for decades mm-hmm. and had their hands, you know, on all of these films. They were lab technicians, they were negative cutters, they processed these films, they sliced mm-hmm. these films. They, you know, they were the people who actually physically made the films.
And right.
So, yeah, it is also, and this is also something I always think about with the materiality of archives. You know, it's the archives are communities of people. And the Afghan Film Archive was very much a community of people who had been involved not only in preserving the archive as an archive, but also in many cases in making the films that constituted that archive, and not just in making them as cinema, but mm-hmm. actually in physically, materially making them as films.
Right. I want to go back to one thing you said earlier, and it actually kind of references my conversation I had with Jihan El-Tahri and about the manifesto and liberate the image. And mm-hmm. you mentioned how you wrote to the Soviet archive initially to ask for the return, mm-hmm. basically the return of this footage to the people. And that is something that Jihan and her colleagues call for and liberate the image, because like you mentioned, archives are so expensive, and particularly how there is particular archives from other countries there's this air of colonization about that. Mm-hmm. There has been a call for the return of these images. And I just want to kind of, if you could like speak more on that. I know you mentioned that one experience, but in your work with the Afghan film, have you like reached out to entities in other countries besides the Soviet Union who might be footage to ask for like the return of items to be part of the Afghan archives so the people can have access to it?
Yeah, so in that particular case, it was actually the head of the archive who wrote the official letter requesting the return of the footage. It wasn't me, because I'm not an official government in any way.
Okay, right?
It wouldn't mm-hmm. have made sense if it came from me.
Right.
So I'm not aware of any other specific cases like that, although there may have been some. Mm-hmm. That's the only story that I know about. Mm-hmm. Historically, Afghan Film and later the National Archive, which took over the Afghan Film Archive, has been very unwilling, generally very unwilling to let the films leave the country. They did at one point allow the National Film Board of Canada to scan about 20 films.
Okay.
But those were all returned. They were scanned as part of a kind of deal around the production of The Forbidden Reel, which was an NFB film.
Right.
And there was supposed to be a kind of larger collaboration happening around that, which I think fell apart because of lack of funding. So unfortunately, those were never really like fully restored or anything like that. Trying to see if we can do anything with them now.
Right. It's complicated. It's complicated because like a country wants to hold on to its heritage, its history, you know, but then it gets tricky when you're talking about a country that is at war, you know, and governments are unstable and you don't know if a government's coming in that really wants to, who really wants to erase that history. Yeah. So like, I guess my question is like, how can like maybe those of us who are not from a particular country, how can we support, how can we support like organizations like Afghan Film and its preservation? I mean, ideally it'd be cool if there could be some like kind of cooperation or exchange, not exchange, but where the main archives originals are in one place, but then like the other ones, copies of it are stored, like, you know, with what you mentioned with the national, what the National Film Board did, but what can we do to help preserve these heritages?
The general idea that you're kind of referring to, which is actually the way that archivists normally approach it now, is to leave material archives in place and reproduce digital copies in other countries for safekeeping, for security, for restoration, whatever, but to always leave the material copies in the original country, in the original community. That is generally standard practice in archiving now. And that is what was the plan also with the Afghan Film Archives. It just didn't really get carried out. So now we're kind of at this moment left only with really specific films that were, you know, in progress in some way in other places. My team had been working on restorations pro bono for specific films by the directors who were interviewed and what we left unfinished as kind of part of our ongoing process of what we left unfinished, I would say. Kind of our ongoing relationships and kind of thinking around the film was that we should also do something for each director who was in the film. We should restore one of their finished films, basically, and put it into circulation. And so we have copies of those films because we were working on those restorations.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Yeah. Like, I would definitely, like, I want to see some of these in their full entirety, you know, as much as possible. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely worth seeing there. And the NFB has, I presume they kept the full scans of the films that they scanned. And I think there may be a few other things in a few other places, but I don't know what has been or will be the fate of the files, the digital files and the material objects that, you know, were held in the National Archive at the time of the government's collapse. I just don't know. I just don't know. And I think in terms of what people can do to support, you know, the community of people that is also the archives, you know, they need support.
I'm big about specifics. So what are some specific things that, you know, we can do? Yeah.
Well, there are people who are at risk and still in Afghanistan who need sponsors for visas and help, you know, paying for visas, and will need help with resettlement later, with mentorship and educational placement or fellowship placements, things like that. There are filmmakers also that we're still trying to help leave and, mm-hmm. you know, get to a new place and, you know, find support for in that new place. It's basically all the things that all Afghans at risk need right now, which is
right.
mm-hmm. help with travel, help with visas, help with resettlement, and like thinking in the long term, like, what do they do? How do they connect to community? Mm-hmm. How do they continue to develop professionally once they're in a new place, right? Mm-hmm. All of those questions. Yeah.
Okay.
Because, you know, one of my things I've really been trying to think about, you know, now that the sort of madness of the emergency evacuation is over and we're settling into this longer, slower, harder work,
mm-hmm. right.
of the long-term process, is really thinking about not just day two or day three, but month six, month 12, you know, year two, year three, year five, you know,
what will that look like? People?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And how do you really plan for that? And how do you really help people get to that? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, we have to wrap up, but I always like to give our guests the last word. So any final thoughts about things we discussed today? Mm-hmm. Anything you want to bring up that we didn't delve into? But also I would like you to include your final thoughts, if there are any organizations that we should know about where we can like either donate or learn how to sponsor, like mm-hmm. if people are able to do that. So if you could include that in your final thoughts, mm-hmm. that'd be great too.
Okay, great. Well, I would say one thing we didn't talk about that I think is really important to the film is the sound. Yeah, the sound design in the film, which connects to the way that we worked with this fictional material within, you know, this documentary framework. And that's really thinking about how to present these films as films and the decision to construct full scenes mm-hmm. from these movies, you know, because of course, most of them, we only had raw footage.
Right.
And the feeling that we had after a rough cut that looked completely different and didn't totally work, as they so often don't work, documentary rough cuts. But the feeling that we had that in order to understand why these filmmakers went to such lengths to keep making films, you had to actually see their films, right? Mm-hmm. And see the kind of the joy, right, that results.
Yes.
That resulted from these insane efforts to keep making films. And then, you know, where the sound comes into that is all of this Foley that we did to kind of fill out the life worlds of these clips, because mostly we didn't have any sound.
Oh, really?
Did you
just have like audio from the actors, but they...
No, we had nothing. We had nothing.
You had nothing. Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
There was nothing. We only had audio for some of the clips from Agent. That's why you hear a little dialogue from Agent. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have any audio for any other films. So.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So we made all of it. We made all of that Foley, and we made it kind of in the style of films from that region in that period. Right.
So yeah, because like
exaggerated.
I know, but it seemed to fit. Like yeah. I didn't. Yeah. So I mean, that's what it was meant to do. Okay.
It's meant to kind of feel seamless. It's meant to feel fit seamlessly with the clips from Agent that did have sound, mm-hmm. and it's meant to kind of really just feel of that era. It's meant to feel like these clips are clips from movies that exist, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. But that's all an illusion because they didn't exist and they never existed, right? Yeah. And the other thing is that the ambient sound in those clips actually comes from our present day footage. So these mm-hmm. kind of matching shots that we did where we have footage from the same locations that were used in the archival films. And there's this mm-hmm. kind of like really subtle continuity between the audio in the present day shots and the audio in the mm-hmm. archival footage, because it is actually the same sound.
Space.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, so I always like to just point that out because it's the thing I'm proudest of in the film is the sound design. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes.
Also, 70% of the footsteps are mine. So.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay.
DIY it's, Foley. It's like
exactly.
Me and five different pairs of shoes.
I love it. Like, this is me walking. I love it. Awesome. And then organizations that are out there, maybe who are like have like websites that we should go to so we can, you know, help preserve these, you know, help preserve these archives, but also help these Afghan artists who are doing this work of preservation.
Indeed. So you can go to artsforafghanistan.org. Which is the sort of ad hoc coalition that I was humbly part of organizing. There's a whole list of resources at that website that links to many other great organizations that are doing this work. And we'll have a very specific fundraiser up on there very soon as well.
Okay, great. Okay, good, good, good. So we will make a point to highlight that. Yes. Money.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. Well, Miriam, thank you so much for being on the show today. And thank you to the Doc Leipzig team for allowing Renelle and I and the What's Up with Docs podcast team to be a part of this. And I just love this opportunity to talk about archives because I think archives in the documentary space are like my first love. So yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy.